everyone. My name is Ron Way. I'm going to be your host today on Author Talk and Rising Light Media. And what a show we have for you. Foremost is the discovery announced by our guest in his magazine last week of the actual signature seal from the prophet Isaiah. And it was found, get this folks, within feet of the earlier discovered seal of the King Hezekiah. What are the odds? It has been buried for almost 3,000 years, and today you're going to hear all about it. Folks, you're in for a rare treat. I'm interviewing a very talented man, Dr. Robert Cargill, who is the editor of the Biblical Archaeology Review magazine, known as BAR, B-A-R. Dr. Cargill has so many credits to his name that if I tried to list them, I'd have no time for an interview. Yet, I will make a humble attempt to list just enough to them to impress you and make you sit up and listen to the amazing story this man is about to tell you. Dr. Cargill is an archaeologist and an author, his latest being The Cities That Built the Bible. He has also authored a 3D virtual reality reconstruction of the archaeological remains of Qumran, near where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, entitled Qumran Through Real Time. He has hosted television shows and appeared on ABC, CNN, Discovery, the History Channel, and Nat Geo. Okay, you get the picture now? Let's meet the man. Welcome to Author Talk. Robert, how are you?
Doing well, Ron. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I know that I have more questions than we'll have time for, but I have to start with the headliner, the Isaiah Signature Seal, which is part of a two-part issue that your magazine is putting out, Biblical Archaeology Review. And if you'll allow me, I want to take this piecemeal. I want to explore this discovery sequentially. Let's set the stage for our folks and tell them about how amazing the finding of this little clay seal is, because this clay seal brings to life some of the biblical stories and characters from the Old Testament. The Bible records in 2 Kings that King Hezekiah trusted the prophet Isaiah's counsel to protect Jerusalem from the Assyrian siege. For those of us who are not familiar with the Old Testament, can you tell us who the prophet Isaiah was and how he fit into the history of Israel? And then I'll ask you about the archaeology of it all.
Sure. The prophet Isaiah is one of, if not the most popular or well-known of the Hebrew writing prophets. So, you know, there's Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Those guys are pretty popular. But Isaiah is quoted more times in the New Testament than any other prophet. And there are more copies of Isaiah's writings among the Dead Sea Scrolls than all of the other prophetic texts combined. So this was an incredibly popular prophet. And according to the biblical tradition, again, we don't have any, at least prior to this discovery, and again, we have to talk about whether or not this is the signature of the prophet Isaiah, but we don't have any archaeology prior to this. All we have is the biblical tradition, and according to that biblical text, it shows that the king Hezekiah relied heavily on the prophet Isaiah for counsel. And this was not unique. We know that kings often relied on prophets as like senior advisors, as counselors. We know that, for instance, King David had the prophet Nathan. Now, Nathan wasn't necessarily a writing prophet, but he was the court prophet. He worked there in the court, and David would go to him and ask him questions. And we remember the story of how Nathan revealed to David God knew about what he had done with Bathsheba, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So when crises occurred, you know, the king could go to his secretaries, and he could go to his scribes, and he could go to all of his counselors. But what he could also do is call on the prophet. And, of course, the most famous prophet at this time, according to the Bible, was Isaiah. And so a lot of the text that we have, especially in Isaiah 36 through 39 and the parallel text in 2 Kings 18 through 20, are these problems that Jerusalem and Hezekiah was having with Assyria. They would come in and threaten to sack Jerusalem, and then the text says that Hezekiah paid him off once. And then they came back again and encircled the city, and this time he didn't know what to do, and he prays to God. And the text says that Isaiah responded and said, you know, basically, don't surrender. And he sent a prophecy. So from the text, from the biblical text, what we appear to have is Hezekiah relied on Isaiah like a court prophet. That doesn't mean that Isaiah was only in the court, like, say, Nathan was. Isaiah appeared to be able to come and go. He was a prophet that, you know, that wandered the countryside. But let's say he had walk-in privileges. He was an advisor to the king, and that was the relationship. He was a trusted advisor to King Hezekiah.
Right.
And he was incredibly popular at the time.
It's a story we've all heard, especially as children, when we're reading these Bible stories about this. And it's kind of an interesting thing. And I picked up on a key word that you said he sent or wrote this prophecy, and I'll get to that in a little while.
That's right. When you'll recall that in Isaiah, I guess it's Isaiah 37, 2 Kings 19, when the Assyrians besieged Jerusalem, obviously Hezekiah did something that the Assyrians didn't like. He rebelled. He quit paying tribute.
Right.
You know, Hezekiah, for all of his good deeds that the Bible credit to him, he was basically a vassal of the Assyrians until one day he decided to rebel. He quit paying tribute. He said, we're going to be independent. And, of course, the Assyrians don't like it when you do that. And so they sent the army. They besieged the city. You have this almost comical exchange between the Rabshake, you know, the representative of the Assyrian army leader down below, and you've got, you know, the representatives of King Hezekiah up inside the Jerusalem city walls.
Right.
And they're basically saying, you need to surrender.
Yelling
and
at each
saying,
other.
You know, yeah, we're gonna kill you, yeah. And then, you know, you have this one funny thing where the Hezekiah's counselors up there say, please don't speak in Hebrew. You're scaring all the people. Speak in Aramaic. We can understand that. And the Rabshakeh is like, of course, that we want to speak in Hebrew. We're trying to scare your people. We want you to surrender, right?
So
we have that with that episode, and it's during that episode that he tells them, we're coming for you. And Hezekiah has a decision to make. They send in the surrender letter, and Hezekiah either has to surrender to Assyria, or he's got to, you know, withstand it and, you know, and face the consequences, which is the Assyrians who come in and sack the city. And so he takes the surrender letter and lays it out on the altar and prays to God. And the text says that Isaiah sent to King Hezekiah. It doesn't say that he came. It doesn't say that he was sent, that he came. And he couldn't get in because the city's under siege. So the idea was that Isaiah probably wrote out some kind of response.
Here's where we're going to get the seal, but you're going a little fast to paint this complete picture, because you are an archaeologist, and that's what the whole magazine's about, is the archaeology to discover these fascinating stories, but it's very difficult to prove them extra-biblical. So what they're trying to do in archaeology is prove, disprove, and in a way explore the same time frame. Now, I want to take you, if you would be kind enough, I know where it was found, and it's fascinating. Most Christians know about the Temple Mount. You've all heard of it, because that's where King Herod's temple was. This is way before that, where Jesus taught, overturned the money changers, etc. But now we want to go back even further, some 700 years even further back in time, to the first temple period. Bob, you're an archaeologist. Give us a bird's eye tour of the ridge line running down from the Temple Mount, which is there today if you go to Jerusalem, through the original city of David, King David. Then tell us all about the general archaeological excavations that have been going on there really for some decades now.
Sure. Jerusalem, modern old city Jerusalem is essentially two hills. There's the western hill, what is today called Mount Zion, which is interesting because in antiquity, at the time of, you know, let's say David, Solomon, Hezekiah,
right,
the eastern hill was called Mount Zion. But today, if you get in Tel Aviv airport and you say, take me to Mount Zion, they'll take you to the western hill. So there's the western hill, and then there's the eastern hill, which is called today the City of David. And Jerusalem was basically the city of David. It was that eastern hill, and you know, the city of David is controversial today because it is on the eastern side of what we call the Green Line, the 1947 borders drawn by the UN. So this would make it part of East Jerusalem. That was then taken by Jerusalem, during the Six-Day War.
Taken by the Israelis, yes.
By the Israelis, yeah. Yes, I'm sorry, by the Israelis during the Six-Days War. And so there are many, obviously Arabs, Palestinians, but also many Israelis, also many Americans, who sympathize with the Palestinians, with the Arabs, who say, hey, the Israelis shouldn't be digging in the city of David because that's technically part of the West Bank or what would be Palestine or East Jerusalem. And, you know, and then there's those who say, well, no, Israel took that in a battle and they control it and they're going to excavate it. And so anything that comes out of this region, the city of David, is controversial.
Right.
When you overlay on top of that the fact that some of these digs are outsourced, if you will, to organizations that have, shall we say, Zionist overtones.
Right.
That, you know, they are very confessional organizations that want to, you know, that very openly talk about, you know, let's make this part of town Jewish again. Let's take this back for Israel. That makes it even more controversial because now you're not just looking at political, now you're looking at ethnic and religious. So you've got all of those tensions, but that's what's going on this eastern hill. And so you start at the bottom of the hill where the Kidron Valley and the Hinnom Valley, Gehenna, come together, and then this would have been where the people lived. And of course, as with most places in antiquity, as you work up the hill, you get towards the palace where the king would live, and of course on the Acropolis, on the top of the hill, you have the temple. So if, for those of your listeners who have been to Jerusalem, have seen pictures, we always see Herod the Great's big temple mount, that big retaining wall that he built up there.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that not being there, and where the Dome of the Rock now sits, that being a very small temple. That would have been the temple. And then just down below that to the south, in what we call the Ophel, so just outside the Herodian Temple Mount walls, that would have been the royal palace complex. And it's there that this little seal and the Hezekiah seal were discovered, in this palace complex, not too far from the temple.
And in this, of course, leading up to the discovery of those two different seals that come from the same time period, and they're discovered, this is the amazing part, they were discovered different time frame for archaeologically, for you guys, modern archaeologists discovered them two different time periods, but one a few years ago. But this one is just discovered about 10 feet from where they discovered the King Hezekiah's, right?
Right. So the Hezekiah seal and the purported Isaiah seal are discovered about 10 feet away from each other. In this Ophel excavation by Dr. Alat Mazar of Hebrew University, and she's been digging there for a decade at least, and she found these two seals in 2009, and has been researching them ever since. She announced the Hezekiah seal in 2015, and then just announced with us this controversial and yet very, very fascinating seal that may have the signature, the seal, seal impression, pardon me, may be the seal impression of Isaiah the prophet.
Are these from the palace area, where the 10 feet apart, is that in where the old palace used to be?
Yeah, it would be in the what we would call the palace complex.
Okay.
So, it wouldn't necessarily, you know, if you think about the White House, it's not necessarily the residence, but it's in the larger you know, the complex there. We're not, you know, Dr. Mazar thinks it's outside of what she calls the Royal Bakery, which would have been where you would bring in kind of central shipping and receiving, where you would bring in goods and materials, so it's not the mail room. It's where they're doing some cooking.
Right.
It's where they're bringing in lots of goods that would have been sealed.
Got
it. She found lots of seals. She found a couple dozen seals. She found a couple dozen seal impressions in this area, and among them are the Hezekiah seal impression and the Isaiah seal impression. So
now it starts to come together, because as you said, let's assume that Hezekiah is sending his prophecy, or maybe several of them, for all we know, this great prophecy. He had to seal that. He was being delivered for him, am I right? And then he would have had to seal it. The seal of those days was something that guaranteed that it came from him. Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, if Isaiah is not inside of Jerusalem when the city is put under siege, and Hezekiah, you know, says, you know, basically, what do I do? Should I surrender, which he's done in the past? Should I pay off the Assyrians and give them what they want and live to fight another day? Or should I stand up and fight? That's what he's basically asking. Should I give in to the Assyrians, or should I stand up and fight? How is Isaiah, who's not in the city, going to get a message to him? And how are you going to be able to authenticate that message? So the idea is that Isaiah would write a prophecy, or have his scribe, you know, have his amanuensis write it for him. And then, you know, they'd have to smuggle it they'd have to get it into the city. How would you know that this came from Isaiah? Well, he would use his ID. He would use his seal to kind of impress on the clay, and that's how you would know that this is his impression. And, of course, we're speculating that it happened to be a writing. You know, it could have been that Isaiah was paying a tax. It could have been Isaiah was buying something to eat, and, you know, he used his seal to create an impression that served as a receipt. You know, people use seals and seal impressions for all kinds of things. But, you know, the idea is, however it came about, we clearly have a seal impression that's got the name Yeshayahu, that's got the name Isaiah on it. The question is, the big, you know, $10,000 question is, is this the seal impression of that Isaiah, of Isaiah the prophet, or is it the seal impression of another Isaiah?
Right. But let me ask you, and this part that bothered me.
Right.
When I saw this seal, and incidentally, you've got it, it's right on the website here, just where you're listening. You can see a picture of it. And of course, you can get the magazine, and hopefully you'll subscribe to it, because this is where you're going to see it not only this month, but the next issue also, second part two. Here's what bothers me. Would it have been unusual or braggadocious, really, to sign a letter to any other document that way? I mean, that would be like me introducing, because it says the prophet, you know? It doesn't say just Ron Way. Be like me saying, I'm signing this thing, Ron Way, the prophet, which is kind of, wow. I mean, would he really have said that in history? That's a title I would expect to be bestowed on people by others, not themselves, saying it, I am.
Right. It's a good question, because when I was first sent this article, and, you know, the story how you know, we at Biblical Archaeology Review got the story, we wrote Dr. Mazar, who's a good friend of Herschel Shanks, and again, this special double issue is essentially a fetch rift for Herschel, who retired, and I took his role as editor of the magazine. So we put together a special issue and asked all of his friends, many major archaeologists in Israel, to write a couple of reflections. And so if you get the issue, you'll go through there and you'll read these funny stories. Some of them tease Herschel a little bit, or tell a funny story of Herschel, you know, what he meant to the field of biblical archaeology. And when we called Alot Mazar, she said, boy, did you call on a good day. How about if I give you something we were going to publish somewhere else? What if we give it to you? And that's my gift to Herschel. And she told me what it was, and I said, yes, please.
You know, yeah.
We'd be happy to publish that. Yeah. And so we just happened to call on the right day, and she sent it to me. And I'm a natural skeptic, right? I'm an archaeologist. I'm a scientist, and I saw this and I went, "No, this can't be right."
Right.
So I started reading through it, and it's very clear. And by the way, everything that I'm saying now, she says in the article. So I applaud Dr. Mazar for taking her time. She didn't run out and hold a press conference and sell tickets and. You know, she didn't say, "We found the seal impression of Isaiah, the prophet." She says everything in the article that I'm saying right now. She says, it's very clear that the name is Yeshayahu. It's very clear that it's Isaiah. Nobody seriously doubts that it says Isaiah. The question is what the name on the bottom register, the bottom line says. And what you can see are three letters. Nun, which is an N. A bait, which is a B or a V, and then a yod, which is an I or a Y, right? So you've got the first three letters of the word prophet, Navi. The question is there an aleph? And the left-hand side there appears to be broken or you know, smudged or something. And so the question is, was there originally an aleph to the left of that word? And if there was, then you very clearly got Isaiah prophet, which would have been the name Isaiah, and you've got his title prophet, which was what would be what you would expect someone who has walk-in privileges, a counselor to the king. That's what you would expect his seal to say, his name and his title.
However, it really was a title in the royal court. He was the royal prophet. Is that what you're saying?
Well, he wasn't necessarily the royal prophet. He was a prophet. And, you know, you raise another question, very, very interesting question, is, you know, we have a verse in the Bible that says, you know, at this time, prophets weren't called navis. They were called ro'ez. They were called seers. But we do at this time begin to see the word navi appear.
Mm-hmm.
So the word Navi is beginning to appear about this time. And so the question is, you know, were they using the word Navi? And if they were, is this the title being granted him? And then, of course, the question then is, how do you spell Navi? Do you spell it with a yod or not? Because at this time as well, in the Hebrew language, and this is a little bit of a technical thing, but
right.
There are certain letters that can serve as vowels, and early in Hebrew, you don't have them, or they're very, very rare, and later in Hebrew, they're incredibly common. We call them matris lectionis, or plain A vowels, vowel letters, and right around this 8th, 7th century is when they begin to appear a little more frequently in inscriptions, and so you're at this transitional period where we're missing the aleph at the end, and if it's there, we might have the seal of Isaiah prophet. But it's not there, and you do have this letter yod there. So the question is, if it's not Isaiah the prophet, who is it? And that's what scholars are debating. And let me just say this. I'm incredibly proud of Biblical Archaeology View, of the article that Dr. Mazar wrote and of the way we publish this. We didn't declare that we had found Isaiah's seal, a signature. We asked the question, is this what this is? And then we went through and we said, here are the reasons why it could be, and then here are all the technical reasons why it might not be. And then we said at the end, we're not sure. And what I've been very pleased with is all of these scholars, these luminaries, these very, very prominent scholars of Hebrew language, Hebrew Bible, Semitics, Northwest Semitic languages, have been on Facebook and on blogs and you know, and have been debating all of these very technical issues based on an article published in Bar.
Right.
Going back and forth. And if we can do that with we can't do it with every issue,
right.
But if we can do that with Biblical Archaeology Review, if we can get rid of all the sensationalism that you see in the media, if we can get rid of all of the, hey, we found the nails of the cross, and hey, we found, you know, this and that, Noah's Ark and stuff, and if we can ask real archaeological questions, we found this thing, it appears to say this, Here are the reasons why it might. Here are the reasons why it might not. What do you think? If we can inform the public and inform the readers like you do with your listeners on your show, then I think we're doing a public service in the pages of Biblical Archaeology Review, and that's what we did with this article.
Well, that's his opinion. Now, I'll tell you that I think the odds are that it is. What are the odds that you would have a seal 10 feet away from the king's seal with a person that is associated with the king, and it's Bob Smith instead, you know, instead of Bob the prophet that we all know about and talk about? And, you know, the odds are, for me, are just overwhelming. But people can draw their own. That's what the beauty of this magazine is, folks. And before we run out of time, and I got to tell you, we're over time. So I'm going to run over time. This is on my fault because I can't stop you. I just can't. I'm listening to you. And so before we run out of total time, though, and I get cut off, would you talk about your magazine just other than this article? Just tell them what we find in this month after month, year after year, about the Dead Sea Scrolls. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't know about them. I know that you aren't the scholars that translated them, but and or the ones that took the pictures that got snuck out. I interviewed them at the time. But my God, and Qumran, you did a digital version. I don't even know what that's about. I never heard that till I read the magazine.
Right.
And I want to know about that. I have so many questions. Okay, just
sure.
Pick one.
So, about 42 years ago, Herschel Shanks founded Biblical Archaeology Review. And the reason he did so was he found that there was a need for the public to be informed about archaeological news coming out of Israel and, you know, in Lebanon and Jordan and Egypt and, you know, the greater Near East, but of the areas that are associated with the Bible and archaeology. But the public doesn't always understand they're not specialists. They're not technical. You know, they don't read eight languages and they didn't spend, you know, 12 years in grad school. They want to know reliable, credible information, not stuff that's being sensationalized and pushed, you know, for purposes of selling books and tickets. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And so what Herschel started doing was he put together Biblical Archaeology Review, and he got the guys, the men and women who were actually excavating these sites to say, hey, write me a publicly accessible summary of what you're doing. What are you doing? What are you looking for? Why is this significant? And so archaeologists in the Near East began sending him articles with really good pictures. And this is the one thing. This is what attracted me to Barr when I was in grad school. Is if I needed a photograph of something, I would go to Barr because, you know, color pictures are expensive and journals won't really print them.
Oh, I steal your photos online all the time.
That's right, color photos, and especially if you're a teacher or if you're teaching a Bible study or if you want an illustration, this is the place to go. You go to the Biblical Archaeology Society archive, to our library, and you can sign up, you can subscribe, and you can get all of the photos we've ever had on any of the magazines, and you can download them. You can use them in your Bible study, in your PowerPoint, your book club, whatever you want to do. And Herschel found this niche. He found this need that people wanted. They wanted good, credible archaeological information from the people actually doing the digging, but that they could understand. And that was Herschel's. That's what gained him the trust of his readers. Was he was giving them good information that they could understand. And he wasn't in the guild. Here's one of the big differences between Herschel and me. I'm a professor at the University of Iowa, right? I have my PhD and my three master's degrees, and Herschel was a lawyer. So Herschel wasn't a scholar, and he was very proud of this. He says, I'm not an archaeologist, I'm not a scholar, I'm a journalist, I'm a lawyer. I'm going to investigate things. And when he didn't get an answer that he liked, he would go ask someone else. And that bugs certain scholars.
Right.
So, he rubbed some people the wrong way, but he wanted answers. And when he didn't get an answer he liked, he kept pushing and he kept pushing. And, of course, one of the articles in this latest issue is by Marty Abegg about the role, the significant role that Herschel Shanks played in liberating the Dead Sea Scrolls and making them publicly available for study, because up until that point, they were very, very hard to get access to.
And the state of Israel sued him.
One scholar sued him because among these scrolls that he had published was something that this scholar had been working on, and won. The scholar won. Herschel, you know, published an issue and, you know, and put the guy's picture and the guy's name and said, this guy's the victor. He sued me and he won. But the greater role was that Herschel wanted to make sure that the public, that his readers, had access to the truth, to the material that was coming out of Israel. And I must admit, I benefited from that because I then turned around and wrote a dissertation on the archaeology and on the Dead Sea Scrolls, archaeology of Qumran and the Scrolls, which was, this was an entire field of study that was in part made possible by Herschel Shanks and Biblical Archaeology Review. So, you know, he's had this wonderful career. People have this love him or hate him opinion of him. His readers love him. A lot of scholars can't stand him, but that's because he, part of his role is being a thorn in the side of these archaeologists to try to get them to publish in a timely fashion. But at the end of the day, I think we can all appreciate what Herschel did for the public. He brought the news from Israel, from the Near East, from Jordan, from Egypt, to the U.S., to their readers, to his readers, in a responsible fashion. And it's my hope, as one who has training in this field, to build on this legacy, to build on this foundation, and to continue to bring the next generation of archaeologists and scholars, my generation, I'm 45, to bring my generation of scholars, the next guy, the next archaeologists, men and women, who are going to be excavating the Near East, and to get them to continue to provide these stories for Biblical Archaeology Review.
It's an amazing story. Fortunately, I was there during all of that period and was talking about it on ABC at that time, interviewing some of the scholars that actually snuck out and published the photographs, if you will, and then Barr put it out there for everybody to read. And you're right, he lost, but we're the gain.
That's right.
We all got access to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Tell us just a bit about Qumran itself. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in the caves that surrounded this area in the just to the west of the Dead Sea. And and there was buildings there. Just 2 minutes. Just give us a quick review of what was there and why, and how do we get a look at what you did?
Sure. Qumran is one of the most controversial, one of the more controversial sites in the Near East. For a number of reasons, but one being that, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in these caves. The history of their discovery, how they were discovered, is an entertaining story. Several people have written on it. I attempted my best to summarize it in my book, Cities That Built the Bible. The site that was excavated by Roland DeVoe and Gerald Lancaster Harding, who, you know, was working for the the Jordanian Antiquities Authority, and DeVoe was a Dominican monk, and they began excavating this site and began interpreting it essentially as a monastery, right? You know,
correct.
He was a monk, and he was interpreting it as, you know, with the language that he knew. And, of course, you end up with this, what we call the Qumran Essene hypothesis. That is, that whoever it is wrote the people who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls were the Essenes, and they built Qumran. And you have this hypothesis that, from its earliest point, was challenged by scholars. Scholars way back at the beginning were saying, not necessarily, but this story was so popular that it grew and grew and grew until several different people in different periods of time challenged this story. And now the story is once again being challenged. I challenged it. Other scholars have challenged it over time. So the question is, back, you know, who wrote these things? And I would say, I don't ever say that the Essenes wrote the scrolls. I think that they're the best candidates. I think that, but I call them the Qumranites, or, you know, the the Qumran sectarians, whoever it was that was responsible for writing the sectarian literature. The question is, how does one interpret the archaeological information of this of Kirbet Qumran? And scholars have debated it. Several prominent scholars have offered reconstructions. I came along at a time that virtual reality was the new technology, so I attempted to apply a methodology of virtual reconstruction to the site. I did my best to apply good methods, and then I offered my own reconstruction, and that's where people, some people love my reconstruction, some people hate it, some people say, oh, that this is good, and some people say, no, you're dead wrong, and that's every archaeologist's right to do so. But I think what will live on out of my my research is the fact that you can actually bring in virtual reality and 3D modeling to use it to test different reconstructions, to test different archaeological theories. And so that's what I did my dissertation on back in 2008. And from that, I got dragged into, of course, the blood sport, that is, the archaeology of Qumran.
Yes.
Which has led to, as you read in the news last week, the Supreme Court declined to take up a case that involved some pretty nasty scholars behaving badly, involving the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, Larry Shiffman always likes to call it the curse of the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? It's any scholar undertaking any sort of research in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's this legacy of there's this long history of it's half of it's comical and half of it's very mean, and when you mix it all together, you get this there's lawsuits and there's trials and that's what we get, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the most important archaeological discovery of the last century.
Right.
It changed the way we read the Bible.
Absolutely.
And so it's important, and one of the most important things that Herschel Shanks did with Biblical Archaeology Review is help assist in bringing those scrolls to the public.
Correct. And fascinating story it is. You didn't tell us, is your reconstruction available online anywhere?
It has been in the past, and then, websites move around and
right.
change.
Well, if it is, we'll communicate that in email, and then I'll post it for everybody if you can find it.
Yeah, it used to be on UCLA's website, and they redid all their websites, and I don't know if the link broke or whatever.
Okay, that sounds great.
Yeah.
As you can tell, I'm very excited about this. I have been for 2 decades or more, almost 3 decades, and I want to tell everyone that Bob is the editor of the magazine again, that I recommend that everyone should subscribe to. If you're at all interested in the Bible, the Holy Land, archaeology, religion, I would tell you that I have been a subscriber since the early 90s when I met the previous editor, Herschel Shanks, at a convention and interviewed him on the ABC show. I switched to the tablet format. They have it all. You can get a tablet format, which is the way I take the subscription, or you can get the old-fashioned kind in the mail. You can get your magazine, but in any case, you should subscribe to it. It's not expensive, and it's amazing. It's just amazing. That's all I can say. You're a nonprofit organization, right?
We're a nonprofit, and we take a non-denominational, non-sectarian approach, and that was Herschel's. He founded the magazine that way, and that's important to me as well. We're going to present the archaeology to our readers, and then we present the biblical text to our readers. And we never tell anybody what to believe. What we do is we present the biblical text when they're relevant, and we present the archaeology that was discovered, and then we allow our readers to take that information and use it as they see fit.
And I was going to ask you, Bob, to tell people how to subscribe, but the easiest way really is to look at the website that you're on right now, listening to the interview, and click on the image of the magazine below to the left of the interview. It will take you right to the subscription page. There's another image below that even, where if you click, you can get a free ebook. It's about the top 10 biblical discoveries, right?
That's right. You can go to biblicalarchaeology.org, or you can click right there on the button. We have free ebooks This issue, the latest issue, the Arfeshrift to Herschel, is actually available for a limited time for free to view online. So if you go there and you click on the issue right now, you can actually read it. And if you like what you see, then you're welcome to go over and subscribe.
Right. Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob, any last words to our listeners? Because we are fully into over 44 minutes. So we've got a two-episode interview here. But any last-minute words that you want to pass on to everybody before we quit?
No, Ron, I just want to thank you for having me. Look, if your listeners are as smart as the questions that you've asked me today, then I commend you and your listeners. You've got a smart bunch of people here, because what I gave you today was a rather technical assessment of what was discovered. So you're asking all the right questions, and in the coming months, I think we'll find out a little bit more about whether or not this is the actual signature of Isaiah the prophet.
I can't wait. And yes, our listeners come from all over the world, including some of the Arabic states too. And quite a few Muslims that listen as well, which is great, because it gains understanding between us. And that's what we really
need,
folks.
That's right. And that's important. That's an important part of what we do at Biblical Archaeology Review, is we very much try to bring together all of the different peoples of the region, all of the different faiths of the region, and talk about the biblical lands and the archaeology that's going on in them.
That's correct. Well, that's it, folks, for today. I hope you enjoyed digging around with us in the past. And I want to thank you, Robert Cargill, for being our guest today on Author Talk and Rising Light Media. I look forward to our next visit when we can talk more about your own book. Thank you, Robert.
Hey, Ron, thanks. It was great, great working with you. I look forward to it again.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to another fascinating interview here on Author Talk, where you hear some of the brightest and most unusual authors of our time. Next week will be the start of a two-part series with the famous biblical scholar, John Dominic Crossan. Don't miss it. While you are on the website right now, fill in your name and email address on the pop-up that you see on the screen. Don't be annoyed. It goes away if you don't. But that way we can stay in touch, and we'll notify you each time that we post a new material on Author Talk so that you can hear another fascinating interview. Until then, this is Ron Way, your humble host. I remain faithfully yours.